So I'm going to talk a little about how you extract some interesting information from a scattered wave. And so now we're in many people can solve a high dimensional wave function. For example, if you have a molecule, you hit it you put it in a box with absorbing boundary conditions. You drive the field, you let it evolve a little bit, and then you have the wave function high dimension. Often, if you have two electrons, you have a six-dimensional wave function. If you have two electrons plus nuclear motion, you have a nine-dimensional wave function. And it sits somewhere on a supercomputer, and you want to compare with the experiments, you have to extract something from this wave function, right? And the trouble is that this wave function is typically on a small box, as small as possible, because it has to fit in the supercomputer, while the experiment is measuring some far-field data somewhere here, and you don't have it on your computer, right? And the second thing is that there are many processors. You have single ionization, double ionization, other things, and it's all in one wave function, and they often live in the same space, right? So they're, in the same physical space, they're sitting there in this wave function. So how do you extract physical information from this wave function? And I'm going to try to give you a slow introduction into this, right? And so here is just some two, I'm going to use two-dimensional examples from the Schrödinger equation. So this is some 2D Schrödinger equation with some double ionization here and some single ionization. But I'm going to start from the Helmholtz equation, where you see here some scattered wave from the Helmholtz equation. And I'm going to try to combine or merge these two fields or intuitively to see how imaging in Helmholtz equation, how you can also use it in the Schrödinger equation. And so the technique that I'm going to use is some kind of a surface integral technique, and it was first proposed by McCurdy and Rossigno in Berkeley, and it has been then used in several applications and several calculations. But the approach I'm going to take, the final result will be the same, but the approach that I'm going to take is different. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to need something. Okay, so there are two equations that we are going to look at. First is the Helmholtz equation. And so this is some Laplacian, some wave number that depends on space. And some right-hand side, which is basically can model your incoming wave or a source of noise. And so then, so typically you have some Sommerfeld-like boundary conditions at infinity. So that you have only outgoing waves at the boundaries, right? So this is, I'll not denote this as some absorbing boundary condition, right? So the second equation we are going to look at is just the Schrödinger equation, where we have some potentials that depend on x, y, and some two-body potentials, minus b, some scattered wave, and then some initial wave. The same, we also have some absorbing boundary conditions to solve this. Right. The spherical coordinate, right? Yeah. So you map this to spherical coordinates, and then you have some at infinity. You have you need an outgoing wave.
Right. What is u?
U is the solution. The solution, the scattered wave solution.
And the second variable is going to y.
Yeah.
It's x and y.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll start, I mean, the first part will be about the Helmholtz equation, and then we're gonna, I mean, interpret the Schrödinger equation as some kind of a Helmholtz equation and try to see how we can extract the scattered wave from it. Okay, so it's often convenient to rewrite your space-dependent wave number as some k squared. Like this, right? So f would then be zero for all x, y, so you have basically some infinite domain, and there is a square patch where there is some function f of x which is non-zero in this square patch. So this f is only non-zero in this patch, and outside this patch, this basically boils down to a constant wave number, and so you have some medium like air outside here, where you have some homogeneous wave media, and here you have some non-zero f, and typically the refractive index is then interpreted as 1 plus f, right? So this is easy. It's easy to write like this, right? You will see immediately why it's easy.
But now it's a different f from the one you have, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's put here a G. No, G is confusing. In the future.
We will not be able to tell the chi from the chi. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So this F is models some function which has a finite support. And it can model your inhomogeneous media, right? So if you then have your total solution, you write it as an incoming wave of x and y plus a scattered wave of x and y, where your incoming wave is typically some ak cosine theta x plus the big K. And you insert this total solution in the homogeneous Helmholtz equation, you get an inhomogeneous equation for the scattered wave. So you get since this is a solution of the homogeneous equation, if you insert this part and the Laplacian go away, and you put this on the right-hand side, right? And here you now have an inhomogeneous Helmholtz equation for the scattered wave, right? So you typically put this. You combine this with absorbing boundary conditions, and since we have assumed that this f has a finite support in a certain box, we know that this right-hand side is zero everywhere except this box, right? So what we do typically, if we want to solve this numerically, we put it in a box, which is a box which is a little bit bigger than this other box, and we put absorbing boundary conditions everywhere outside here. And we then have a right-hand side, which is only which only lives over here. And then you get a homogeneous Helmholtz equation over here. And then you're sure that all the outgoing waves are absorbed, right? So we assume now, for the remainder of this talk, that we have a numerical method that can solve this equation for a given f and get us the scattered wave. So I'm going to show you an example now. So here is my function f. Oh no, this is the refractive index, right? So I have a material which, so I'm plotting now the refractive index. So I have a material which is 1 everywhere outside a certain region. And then I have a region where locally there is a function f where, I mean, speed of sound is faster, right? Or, I mean, I have a different material, right? So now, so since this is local, I can now create a right-hand side for an incoming wave in a certain direction. This gives me the right-hand side. I discretize this on a finite difference grid. I have the Laplacian with finite differences. This gives you an additional diagonal operator. And I can just put absorbing boundary conditions on the edges and solve for the scattered wave. So this is the imaginary part of the scattered wave. So I have a wave which comes here. And I get this scattered wave. And here it starts to be absorbed by the boundary conditions.
So the green patch is not the little box, it's the big box.
Yeah, it's with the absorbing boundary conditions, right?
So how do you implement the absorbing boundary conditions?
So in this example, it's some PML, which is perfectly matched layers, or some ECS. You can use ECS or any absorbing boundary condition, doesn't matter.
So it's not implemented via that kind of secret condition, but really, you're really, really absorbing, literally.
Yeah, so here, this Sommerfeld condition is a condition on infinity. But, I mean, to do this on a finite range, you have to be sure, I mean, your wave, which is, I mean, you don't know the wave number exactly at each boundary conditions, because in the corners, it's combined of x and y, and you don't want to know all the exact wave numbers of the boundary conditions. So you don't do this like this. So, but for the talk, it doesn't really matter. But in this particular case, it's a PML. Yeah. And so here, the real part. Okay, it doesn't really. Okay. So now the question is, I'm not interested in this thing because the field here is not, I mean, it's not a, has not reached its asymptotic form. I'm interested in what the Chinese intelligence measured of this airplane, right? So that's very far away, and so I'm interested in the far field pattern, and not in the near field pattern, right? So, but I don't own the solution I only own the solution here. So how do I translate this information to the far field? So the idea is to rewrite, I mean, we have this equation, right? So we can rewrite this equation in the following way. We're going to, I mean, we already own U scattered, and we own this. So we're going to move apart from this equation to the right-hand side in a way that we get an equation that we can solve, right? So we rewrite the equation. Better use the key. So this is the same equation, right? I just move this part with the F to the right-hand side. And again, this is something which is, and this is zero for R except the box, right? Because this F shields all this stuff, right?
So what you're trying to do now is you've solved the equation in this box around it. The box is small, and you're, with your perfectly absorbing boundary conditions, you're sort of letting any of the far field escape. Is that going to perturb the near field, though?
No, I mean, you made your absorbing boundary conditions such that there is no reflections, right? There is no information coming back from the from outside. So there is all information is flowing outside.
Right, but you wrote it as a limit as rho goes to infinity.
Yeah, this the equation that I wrote here was the PDE before discretization, right? Okay. Yeah. So this boundary condition here is the formal Sommerfeld equation, right?
Okay, so then you solve it with the boundary.
Yeah, so I solved this with some absorbing boundary condition on the box that I'm discretized, right? So I have not specified this. At the end, I will give some references on papers on the mathematics. I mean, a very good mathematics paper that produce a very good accurate absorbing boundary conditions. I'm assuming that you did it very well and that you have now this numerical solution, right? But we're interested in the far field. I mean, that's what's measured in the experiment, and we don't own it at this moment.
Can I ask something here? If say you wanted to look at ATI at very high energy, I mean, you know, the 100 peak, now your box should be such that does not, the absorbing boundary should be such that does not disturb that signal. So you would like the absorbing boundary, where you put the absorbing boundary, should depend on what you want to look at, isn't that right?
Sure. But I'll get to the Schrödinger equation later. So now we're really focusing on the Helmholtz equation first, right? And so here we have the F, which satisfies certain conditions. It has to be zero outside this box. So this is the first assumption. And later for the Schrödinger equation, you see how to modify this, right? So the cool thing is now, I mean, this is just the same equation. We forget that we own this solution here. Now, this equation was solved on a finite box. We forget that we know this solution, and we solve this equation on the infinite box. So we have a new problem, some phi, a new phi, that we want to solve on the infinite box. So we want to solve this on R2, right? So this is a well-defined problem. I mean, this thing with Sommerfeld boundary conditions here is a regular operator. It has a unique solution. So, and since this is only zero inside the box, we know that if we write this equation, that inside the box, this agrees with the scattered wave. But now we want to solve this outside the box. But the cool thing is that with this equation, we know how to solve. This is a Helmholtz equation with a constant wave number. So we have the Green's function. So we can write now, this solution is actually just the Green's function . So we can find anywhere outside the box, we can find the solution with this Green's function, right? And this Green's function is a volume integral, but typically this is an infinite volume integral. But we know that this thing here only lives inside the box, so we can calculate this integral exactly, or numerically approximate it as good as possible, right? So first we solve on this equation on the numerical box. We have this high-dimensional wave function, or in this case, just a two-dimensional wave function. We then rewrite it such that we get a right-hand side which is only non-zero inside the box. And then we say, okay, we forget that we have the solution. we write a new equation and we can write this solution everywhere where we want to know, even the far field pattern or the short field pattern, right? So we can now do the trick that that Tim Saldi did earlier this week. And so just plug in the Green's function here and take some limits, some Fresnel limits. And so so you can then write the U scattered asymptotically as so this U scattered in polar coordinates, you can write this with let me call this So I'm going to show how this happens, right? So suppose now that you have solved this thing, you denote this as some function which is local. Well, this solution here, if you go asymptotically, it looks just like a spherical outgoing wave with an amplitude that depends on the angle. And this amplitude is actually the Fourier transform of this right-hand side.
So this is a two-dimensional treatment?
Sure.
Is there some real physical situation where this is applicable to which this is applicable?
Well, you will see that the Schrödinger equation is actually where it's applicable. But I think if you take a slice through, but you can you can redo this in three dimensions, right?
Sorry, I can't see what the last term is.
Sine of the angle. So this is easy. So this is a statement. It's easy to see how to do this. I mean, you just have to, this Green's function there is some Hankel function 1, 0 of some Hankel function. This Hankel function has the Hankel function of Z you can write this as some exponential. If Z goes infinity. And you can approximate the square root. Just ask me questions if you're here.
Z equals to what? What's the limit?
Infinity, yeah. So if Z gets very big, this boils down to some exponential function. But the Z here is actually the square root. And then you have to apply the Fresnel, some approximations where this x and y are very big, right? And you will find then that the scattered wave is then indeed some integral from minus to plus infinity. Mm-hmm. And so indeed, this is the Fourier integral of your right-hand side, and this gives you your amplitude. Okay, so for a problem with an incoming and an outgoing wave, and with an incoming wave, this becomes basically the amplitude is then the Fourier transform of our object convoluted by the Fourier transform of the incoming wave plus the Fourier transform of the scattered wave evaluated at those points. So indeed, our right-hand side here consists of products, and you have some convolution of the Fourier transform of the individual functions. Right. But the problem is you cannot use this because you don't own the scattered wave everywhere, right? You don't own the scattered wave everywhere. You cannot do first the Fourier transform and then convolute it. Okay, so now you can do some very nice things with this. If you now have the Born approximation, if you now make the Born approximation, if your scatter wave, you can approximate it as some function multiplied by your incoming wave, so the Born, or what is called also the Ritthoff approximation. You will see that the function that you get here is actually some product of f times the incoming wave plus also the incoming wave. So it's actually some f times e cosine, I wrote cosine here. Right, so if you have a scattering problem where you can make the Born approximation or the Ritthoff approximation, this is something with the incoming wave in here. What you'll see is that in this Fourier transform, you get these additional things here. And they modify the k's that appear here. And your amplitude f is then boils down just to the Fourier transform of your original function. Should be more careful here. So there are these now. Okay, so when you have the Born approximation or the Ritthoff approximation, this becomes some function of the incoming wave, then you will see that this actually becomes the Fourier transform of your object, right? But it's evaluated in a very particular way, right? This here, or this here, is actually if you have your S function in R, you Fourier transform it. This is your object. This actually samples your object in a circle with radius k. Right. So this says, okay, your far field pattern is the Fourier transform of this sampled on a circle with radius k. Right. However, if you now can make the Ritthoff approximation, this circle is shifted by the incoming momentum. So if this is your f, you have your Fourier transform of F, which is an object. Now, if you can make the Born approximation, you sample not in a circle which is centered in the middle. No, the circle actually goes through the center of your Fourier transform. And this thing here is the angle of the incoming wave. Right? So since this momentum of the incoming wave is added to this Fourier transform, the circle shifts in a certain direction related to the direction and the momentum of the incoming wave. Right? Is this clear? Are there questions about this? I mean, this is a, it's for example, if you look in the book from Frank Natterer, on the mathematics for CT scans. It's published by Syme. I think it's in one of the first chapters to where they make the Ritthoff approximation and they show that this is a Fourier transform.
So
yeah, that's the little f, right?
Yeah.
And so this is the idea basically in tomography. This circle gets bigger, I mean, because k gets really big, the circle gets bigger and bigger. And then basically you have a line through your Fourier transform. And then by changing having incoming waves in all the directions, you sample the Fourier transform along all these slices, and by the and then you basically have the information in the Fourier space, and you can do some reconstruction from that, right?
The only point I made is it may be helpful to remember little f is n squared minus 1. So
yeah.
It makes connection with some other approaches.
Yeah. So, but we're not making this Ritthoff approximation in this case. I mean, we're not doing this. We just solve numerically the equation. And most of the cases, there's no Born approximation or Ritthoff approximation. We just have the numerical wave function. And we use, with this, you then get some complicated object, which is related to some incoming wave. But then, of course, the scattered wave, which can be multiple scatter, is also appearing here. And then do the Fourier transform to get the image, right? So this was our object, right? So we can now do this Fourier transform. So here on both axes you see k sine alpha, and here you have k sine omega. And what you see is that this is the Fourier transform of that right-hand side, this thing. And then one of these circles is the actual far field pattern, right? So here already you see that the object was initially kind of a Gaussian object. You see, the Fourier transform still looks like a Gaussian, but I mean, it's not really the contribution of this part. The incoming wave is on about half of the contribution of the scattered wave, right? And so the far field pattern is, of course, just a sample or a line along one of these circles for the given momentum that you actually have, right? Okay, you can do, okay, so is everybody with us now? Are there any questions? Okay, so now you can do a nice,
excuse me? I'm just saying 50%.
Okay, yeah. So now you can do a nice trick, and actually instead of doing this volume integral, you can do a surface integral.
I have just maybe a quick question. So that U scattered that you've defined there in terms of this f of alpha and k, is that your small phi, really? Because U scattered was originally just a scattered solution in that box. and then you wrote phi in terms of Green's function and the solution inside the box.
Yeah, exactly.
So is that quantity really
phi? Yeah, that's really phi.
They agree inside the box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the far field pattern, right?
Far field.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you can calculate this f, the far field pattern, as function of the angles, as some surface integral with a function u. I'm confusing things. This is really u scattered. So you have your numerical box, and this is your support of your right-hand side, right? Well, you can calculate the far field pattern by just a surface integral around this thing, right? And the u, the function u, are actually solutions of the homogeneous equation for just plane waves. So plane wave for a certain direction. So we'll see in a second that this u is a plane wave which contains actually the information about the angle where the wave is going. So you take some plane wave solutions for a certain direction. For example, this direction. Then you take your numerical solution, which you own here, right? Because you do this right before you start, your absorbing boundary starts to set in. When you do this surface integral, you will get the same f there, right? And so to prove this, it's rather easy. So you know only, so you can calculate this surface integral with just the numerical solution that you have.
Gradient with respect to what?
To the outward direction, right? So to the normal of your surface.
Wait, does it depend on the direction you choose for your plane waves? That's alpha?
No, so alpha is the direction of the plane waves, and your function u is, I mean, this alpha here, of course.
Yeah, okay.
So to calculate this, you take just a plane wave in the direction of alpha, and you calculate this surface integral. Well, you use Green's second identity, which is basically this is what we are going to use, and let's define u of x, y for a direction, for a momentum k in the direction alpha, as just a plane wave in that direction. And so we know that it fits this equation, the homogeneous Helmholtz equation with constant wave number. Okay, so we already know that f is this volume integral, right? So we already know that this F can be written as a Fourier transform, volume integral, with this plane wave, with this the right hand side of our equation. Okay, but this here, this fitted we have solved the scatter equation in this region exactly such that this equation was correct. So this we can replace by the Laplacian times constant k times the scattered wave, the numerical wave function, right? So we get the u of alpha minus u scattered, which is still a volume integral. And then we use this Green's second identity. If you insert this, you will see that you get the volume integral over a u scattered, the gradient of u, plus some, is it still, should I write it on top? I'm sorry.
Does not make it as a half yet.
So the idea is just to take the Fourier transform, take the u as this plane wave, and this thing that we have here, we replace it by the Laplacian times k times the scattered wave, right? So now we have the plane wave, the Laplacian minus k, and the scattered wave, and we have this volume integral. We then use the second identity, and we get so we have this volume integral. We split it in two parts. We keep part with the Laplacian, and we keep another part, right, with just k. The other part just remains here, which is still a volume integral. The part with the Laplacian, we can replace by, I mean, the part with the Laplacian is just one part over here. It's actually one of these parts, right? So we can replace, we can move this to the other part, and so we get this by Green's identity. Now you see this surface integral, that's the thing that we want to get. Now you realize that what happens here is the Laplacian applied to u scattered, and here you see k times the same u. So you can actually use that the u, the plane wave, is a solution of this equation. So these two terms, they're just zero, because the u is a plane wave. So you just get this scattered wave from this surface integral. Right? Okay, so this was the Fourier transform. The far field pattern is just a circle through this thing. We can calculate that circle by a volume integral. Right? So if you look at the far field pattern, and here is the angle of escape, you see a strong peak in the forward direction. The blue line is actually calculated through the Fourier transform. The dotted line is just the surface integral, right? If you zoom in, you'll see small errors. Errors in both, but they, I mean, you know, I have to realize to do this surface integral, I'm just using, you have to calculate these gradients, and I'm just using finite differences to this thing. This, they introduce a small error, but they're tiny, basically. Right.
So your point is that this is simply cheaper to calculate than the volume integral.
Yeah, and it's you only need your scattered wave. You don't need the incoming wave. You just have the solution of your linear system. This is how you calculate it in MATLAB. Let's see. Here, right? So I just construct a plane wave. I calculate the gradient of this plane wave. I also calculate the gradient of the solutions. And then you have just some sums over rows and columns of your matrix. I mean, it's just slices of this thing. So this is a very tiny code that you have to do. Okay, so this completes the part about the Helmholtz equation. So if this is 3D, or you just put it in a box, you have 8 processors running. I mean, these systems in 2D are just fractions of a second to solve, and so it's very easy to get this far field pattern from a finite box, right? Or anywhere outside the box, you can reproduce the solution. Okay, so now to the Schrödinger equation. So there is a whole parallel literature in solving the Helmholtz equation, mainly in applied math, right? So they're solving acoustics or electromagnetic waves, and they often very high dimensional, and they have very efficient methods to solve those linear systems, right? So, but this literature, they have a special absorbing boundary conditions. They call it PML, perfectly matched layers. And it's actually ECS reinvented. And there are thousands of papers on these absorbing boundary conditions. And they live in a different world from the Schrödinger equation. And there is, they don't even talk to each other, right? So.
Maybe you should just say what ECS is, because the problem doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, ECS is exterior complex scaling, right? So to create, you create a grid. Maybe that's a good exercise. So you create a grid here with your Helmholtz equation, and then instead of using real coordinates, you start to scale into the complex plane, right? So you add an imaginary part over here. The thing is that every outgoing wave will actually become a damped wave. And every incoming wave will actually be an increasing wave. And so by applying Dirichlet boundary conditions, forcing the solution to be zero over here, you remove all incoming waves, actually. Right? So you remove all incoming waves. So effectively, by enforcing Dirichlet boundary conditions over here, you're making sure that here you only have outgoing waves. Right? And the nice thing is that if you have a numerical solution in 1D, you want to extract scattering information, what you do is you calculate the Wronskian with your scattered wave, with an incoming wave. And if you write this out, it is actually just like the surface integral in one point. You have some plane wave, the scattered wave, so if you would, I mean, the surface integral ID was take a surface around your object and extract scattering information. Here, if you reduce it to 1D, actually just take your numerical solution, and in one point you put the surface integral, but that's actually just taking the Wronskian at one point, and it's actually just the same expression, right? Okay, anyway. So now the Schrödinger equation. So the model that I'm going to use is just a 2D. So this is a 2D Schrödinger equation. So you should interpret this as, for example, if you do a two-electron problem, which is originally a six-dimensional wave function, you expand both angles in spherical harmonics, and then you get basically a partial wave of this object. Well, you should interpret this as the equation for one particular partial wave of this two-electron wave function, right? So you have...
You have also a second derivative in Y.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, so this is the kinetic energy in a certain partial wave for the first particle. This is the kinetic energy in the for the second particle. And x and y should be interpreted as radial coordinates. So typically you have boundary conditions.
But then your energy is not divided by
x
squared, it's radial.
Yeah, but it's... Yeah, it's a radial coordinate, but then you pull out the R variables, right?
That's not the radial particle passing, huh? I mean, you got the angular part correct, but the radial part is not just d by x, d by R squared.
Yeah, but you can multiply.
The radial part, and you're going to get one over R, the angles for the radial part.
Sure, but then...
Well, you need also the boundary conditions that have...
You mean rescale the wave function and the...
So we basically have a two-dimensional domain with Dirichlet boundary conditions over here and absorbing boundary conditions over here. Right. And then you can basically interpret this as a Helmholtz equation. So for the examples that I'm going to show, L1 and L2 are just zero, but in principle you can do this for any. And then you can write this stuff as minus k squared of x, right? And just say, okay, this is a 2D Helmholtz equation with, instead of the full space, we have a quarter of the space. with zero boundary conditions over here, zero boundary conditions over here, and outgoing boundary conditions over this space. So in, the other problem was like this full problem, right? Okay. So I mean, these are just some toy problems. So this is some potential, right? So if I take for V1 the potential minus the exponential some Gaussian, and V2 minus 5 minus y squared, and here I take some Gaussian which depends on the relative x and y times some scaling, you could basically get this potential, right? So here on this axis, maybe better it's to rotate this a little. So here you have some attractive potential for the first particle. You have some attractive potential for the second particle. And then here in the middle, the two particles repel, right? So you see here some attractive potential, here some attractive potential, and here some repulsion, some two-body interaction, right? So this is just a Schrödinger equation. This can model a central potential and two particles attracted to this particle, and then some repulsion between the two, right?
What do you do if you have a really long-range interaction? Because in the analysis of the Helmholtz equation, you assume true short-range interactions.
Yeah, that's the point that I want to make in the end, right? So this is the potential. I mean, if you translate this to the Helmholtz equation, we can say, okay, we have we get some. What is this thing? Okay, don't look at the blue part, but at the red part. Okay, so if you translate this to a refractive index, I mean, you look at the Helmholtz equation and you don't know that it's a Schrödinger equation, but you translate this and then you calculate the refractive index, you'll see that you'll have a part where you have just homogeneous space. And then along the axis, you will see that the refractive index is higher, right? And so typically what you see along the axis is that the refractive index is higher. And so what you will have is that indeed, if you have a material with a high refractive index and another refractive index, if you come along have a very low angle of incidence, you will see that you will get trapped in this region over here. It's like a waveguide or some optical communication channels, right? So you will see that you typically, if you would just look at it and give it to somebody who knows a lot about optics, he will say what you will get is evanescent waves here, right? So there are waves that are trapped and cannot enter this material, right? The same here, you will see that you have basically a waveguide here which corresponds to people over here. And we'll see in a minute that this actually corresponds to single ionization, right? So indeed, if you look at the scattered wave, so what I have as an incoming wave, I have one particle bound. I mean, I have take this part plus this part is just attractive enough to have a particle in a bound state. And then I can have an incoming wave in the other particle. So I have basically a bound system there, and I have an incoming wave here. This is my incoming wave. And then I can calculate the scattered wave. And in the scattered wave, you will see the breakup, which is actually just here. And then, of course, the trapped waves, the evanescent waves, or basically single ionization, where you just have, I mean, you scattered in, you leave one particle behind and see the other thing, right? So the hard thing is now, what do they measure in the experiment is a far field pattern. They measure either single ionization or the double ionization. And what you see here is that the two things are entangled in the same region in space. So now, how do you calculate or extract the interesting information from this numerical solution? Okay. So the idea is the following. Do the same trick, right? We have some Laplacian. So we have this thing, we have this solved, we have this thing, and normally what we would do, we would put some stuff to the right-hand side until we, of course there is a minus V here. So until we have some stuff, some equation that we can actually solve. So the first attempt that you would do is the following, right? Just move E here, forget that we have this solution. We have some initial skip 8, which can be the dipole operator or anything. In this case, it was an incoming wave. And we will put Vx here, V2 here. Yeah, let's put this stuff together. Okay. So the question now, Is this a good idea, right? Because we need it, I mean, we know the Green's function for this stuff here, it's just the same Green's function. And we need it, and once we have that Green's function, we can calculate this integral. However, this thing we need, I mean, this integral needs to be calculated over a volume which fits in the box, right? But now, in this case, this function does not kill everything. I mean, we're not sure that this thing is zero, and it's easy to see. Here what you see, you have one body operator on a wave function which actually fills space, right? So you have a one body operator which on a function that fills space. So this thing is not zero, because here we have this one body operator can, for example, kill this region or anything here, but it will not kill this region. So you'll see that you will have combinations that don't make sure that you have basically a Green's function with some right-hand side with a finite box, which in your numerical box, right? So the idea is, instead of calculating the Green's function for this thing, you will put, you will keep the one body operators over here and just put the two body operator here to screen this thing. And I deliberately took a two body operator which actually screens everything, right? So here, so if you just take the two body operator, it really kills everything, so the right-hand side. So you, what you have to do is you have to calculate the Green's function for the separable problem with one-body operators, right?
But of course, the physical electron-electron interaction doesn't do that. It remains finite as long as your electrons coincide. So no matter how far you go, so what do you do then?
Yeah, I'll come to that. Right. But, I mean, this is clear, right? Okay, when you do that, when you calculate that Green's function, you will get basically the regular and irregular solutions of the, I mean, you have to do the Fourier transform is now to the basis of the one electron states. And this is then the Fourier transform in that basis of one electron states, right? And the real scattered amplitude that you measure in the experiment is a slice through this. And you can calculate this either by this volume integral or by a surface integral, right? And this is what is done. So here is, for example, here is what they typically call the SDCS, right? The single differential cross section, which actually gives you the energy sharing between the two particles that escape, right? So they can, I mean, a particle that escapes in this direction, you will measure with relative momentum, which depend on the angle. You can calculate the probability of this, and this is done both with the volume integral and the surface integral. And what you'll notice here are some numerical artifacts here, because I have to calculate these regular functions, my test function, my functions, my plane waves in these one-body operators. I do this also with this ECS, and here you see that I'll get some artifacts from the absorbing boundary condition, because here we'll have a very one electron which is very, very low in energy, or one particle which is very low in energy, and it actually starts to reflect off my edge. But you'll see that this is the SDCS, and you can calculate it either by this volume integral or by this surface integral. So this is the example for a short-range potential.
If I would have just projected on these states, would there be any difference here? I mean,
well, certainly.
I thought always the reason why McCurdy and Ruskinu formulated the sketching problem in this fashion was because they had the problem with exterior complex scaling with boundary condition.
Right.
Therefore, they wanted to have this special form to avoid the question of what to do with the complex scale part.
Right.
But is it now offering something more on this problem of how to disentangle, or is it just a projection on the?
No, I mean, that's exactly the message that I want to communicate, right? So if you read the original paper of McCurdy, it's just some surface integral. It's not clear where it's coming from, right? And so by telling, it's much more than that. It's actually taking your numerical solution and transporting it from your numerical box to the far field pattern.
So it's projected?
It's not projecting. It's really calculating this Green's function, using the Green's function. If you look at it, it looks like projection, but it is more. It's taking the Green's function and transporting your solution from your numerical box to the far field pattern.
I think that we all come back to the same question, of course. Where is the long range part?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because as long as it is short range, it's clear that you can do whatever,
yeah,
because you can solve it outside.
Yeah.
So this is the magic part you have postponed.
Can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So this is exactly what you will see is that indeed, if you have a long-range part, and it will, for example, live here, right? So if you have a two-body potential here, and you will, your right-hand side, if you have a right-hand side, your potential will look like, your right-hand side will look like this, right? For your Green's function, right? So along this thing, if you have a plane wave coming here, and you multiply it by the two-body operator, and you will see that there is a region in space where your right-hand side is not zero, right? Yeah? So where this is zero. However, if you you will make a zero here. So what you see if you do the numerical calculation of the volume integral, that for bigger and bigger boxes, you will see that the only thing that affects this thing is right in the middle. Right here. So when you do this calculation, you will see that these unequal energy sharing, they settle very fast, right? So you do this Green's function, you're missing always, I mean, you have your volume integral, g, and you have some error, which is g coming from this region. I mean, you left out a part of this Green's function. You're leaving out this thing. This thing that you leave out only affects this equal energy sharing. You will see that this settles very fast, and that you will see small things increasing over here, even for the Coulomb problem. Because of Coulomb problem, the only partial wave where this is really dominant is the S waves, right? For the higher partial wave, this decays faster and faster. So you will see in the S wave, partial SDCSs, that you will see a part here in the middle which doesn't settle right away, but you need a little bit bigger boxes, right? But this is, I mean, this is controllable. I mean, you can really write down an upper bound for the error that you make, right? Is this answering your question, or?
So you're saying that you have one special point that this doesn't work and it works everywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, it's controllable. You know exactly what mistake you're making.
Yeah, but for that point, it will never work, no matter how much box you go to.
Well, this, I mean, even in for a Coulomb thing, this thing decays, right? The S wave potential decays, right? So this is always getting smaller and smaller and smaller, right?
So you're getting valid, an actual value with a small error.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if Ken Taylor, for example, just counts what is there and there and there, and then he changes the box size and says, okay, it converges, he doesn't see more coming as double ionization in the central path. It looks a little bit like the same thing, just in a very simplified fashion, not maybe a mathematical apparatus, but of course he observes the same thing, that what he counts in the diagonal, at least is what he claims, is constant at some point. So if you change the box, this value will not change. Otherwise, of course, you couldn't define double ionization. Is this what you're saying somehow? This is a mathematical...
This is not what is written in the papers, but what I try to do is combine what is known for the Helmholtz equation with the Schrödinger equation, and okay, this is a consistent view. And now with this view, you can say, okay, it's not projection, it's translating, transforming your numerical solution and try to calculate the far field pattern, right? It might be that projection is a good approximation to this, but there is more sound background in this. Sure.
I guess I'm missing a little context here. The first example, Helmholtz, you got an incoming wave. Okay, I understand that. And now they're talking about double ionization and stuff like that, which makes me think the numerical part of this problem that you have to do is some kind of time-dependent Schrodinger evolution, right, with some external radiation field. So you haven't really talked about that. I mean, in your little toy example, you said you have an incoming wave.
But this is time-independent scattering.
Yeah.
No, but it seems like everybody's interested in these.
Well, in double ionization, let me...
I just want to know...
Well, so in double ionization, your right-hand side...
Okay.
So I talked about the right-hand side, and I constructed...
Right.
Yeah, this right-hand side. So this can represent both some scattered wave, right? Then you have the... If you have a scattered wave... I mean, if you have an incoming wave, this will always fit some part of this operator, right? For example, if you have a bound state in one of the channels, it will be an eigenfunction of one body operator over here. And if you have an incoming wave in the other part, it will not satisfy that other part. So your right-hand side becomes basically the two body operators multiplied by this incoming wave, right? So you can have an incoming wave. This can represent some incoming wave, and it will be find its support, right? On the other hand, if your initial state is some ground state of a molecule, this thing will just be the dipole operator working on this ground state. So this right-hand side can either represent some photon that hits the molecule, and that gives a source of perturbation, or it can be an incoming wave by this thing. So if we talk about double ionization, we have a photon that hits it to break it up.
You're not talking about high field kind of things. So photons are perturbative. Oh, okay, then I'm fine. I thought you guys were blasting things with a laser and you have a time dependence.
Well, actually,
not today.
Actually, if you look at this paper here, and that's actually blasting the molecule in a laser. So what happens is that and this is a nice extension of this thing, you have a molecule in a ground state, you drive it by a time-dependent wave function, right? And you evolve it until the end of the pulse, right? So you have then a state, which is my current state. Then you ask for yourself, now you switch to the time-independent picture.
Yeah, I thought you've been doing this all along, okay? But now that you explained this is at most a perturbation, that will operate on it.
Yeah, but in this other picture, it's not a perturbation, right?
I know.
Yeah, you're at the end of the thing, and that gives you a right-hand side for your thing. You're now going to do the Laplace transform and do
after
it.
After the pulses.
Oh, right, and that's what they do here in this paper, where they actually calculate some single and double ionization of helium, and they... So they have some cross-sections, actually, depending on the length of the pulse, they have other parts of the cross-section, and they can extract this angular distribution of the escaping electrons, and that's exactly what they do. So they evolve the pulse to the end, then they solve the driven equation, and from that scattered wave, they extract all the interesting properties, right? Yeah. And indeed, you have to be sure that at the end of the pulse, the wave function still fits the box, right? And then you still have to solve this problem, right? So the hard numerical problem is actually find the right numerical methods that cover, I mean, this right-hand side, right? That cover the support of your problem, right? And if you have, and that's one of the problems, if you have pulse probe experiments, you have a pulse and this wave function is like this. Then you wait until the probe comes. I mean, this gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You need bigger and bigger computers to do this. And so it's really a challenging, I mean, it's more becoming an applied math problem than a physical problem, right?
Okay.
So I hope that the way that I told you, that's clear that this is it's more than projecting. It's using the Green's function of the problem to extract far field information. And any, I mean, the numerical box, we want to keep it as small as possible. However, that poses the problem: how do you extract the useful physical information from the problem?
And the Green's functions you have analytically?
Yeah.
For the finite L also.
Excuse me?
For the finite Ls also, for the non-zero?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you calculate the Green's function from the one part of the wave function.
Sure.
So it's an expansion.
It's not
analytical in that sense.
Yeah, but you need only the far field thing, so it's not the complete free function, right? You need the only far field pattern. You don't need nearby the experiment. I mean, like, so you...
Are you saying because it's a far field, you actually use analytic one electron eigenfunctions?
Yeah.
Oh, in that sense, you do have it analytically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for example, if we did some other calculations, let me show. For example, if you do double ionization in a molecule, H2, if you want to, then you also have this amplitude, which is expressed as a volume integral. But these functions here are actually then the eigenstates or the regular solutions of your H2 problem, right? So you need to solve your H2 problem exactly for an incoming wave for a given direction. You use this, and this goes then in the surface integral, but now you have the sum over all partial waves, and you get a complicated sum, right? So you do the surface integral with the one electron, I mean the H2 plus solutions, scattered solutions, right? You have a product of those things, And that's what you do.
So can I ask something?
Sure.
So that I can understand it. Because I right now do not understand exactly the advantage of this technique over what, for example, Alejandro said about well, people that are doing it, you know, with projection.
Right.
They also have to deal with an error. They can see well, what the convergence is,
sure.
How fast they converge,
right.
And that's that. But it's the, from what I understand, it's also the same story here. Because when you have your prologue interaction, again, you have to deal with an error. Again, you have to understand how big your box has to, how you have to modify your box so that you can control the error that you're doing. So what's the advantage?
Well, I mean, it works. It has been working. It has been working for many things.
That is not working.
What?
In the other case,
That's not, I mean, I never did other things, right? I mean, this is, I mean, we did the H2 double ionization. It predicted the experiment and many other things. So, but the reason why I'm telling this story is that, I mean, there is often the confusion, you're doing projection. And no, I want to elaborate on this, that it's not simply projection. It's more than projection, and I've also tried to make the connection with imaging in the Helmholtz equations, right? So if you want to image or to extract some information from these cross sections, by looking at this in this way, you know what imaging, how it works in the Helmholtz equation. Can we now do it here? I mean, it's sort of like a more complete framework. But I'm not saying that it's incorrect. No, I'm saying that I'm doing more than just projection, right? And it offers a way to disentangle from this wave function the cross section. Does this answer your question, or?
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I have a similar question in that you just said that you're using the one particle Green's functions. I understand very well the projection to take the solution at a finite radius and project to infinity.
Yeah.
That's great, but you're using the one particle Green's functions. So what happens to the electron-electron repulsion between the time you stop propagating numerically to the time you project?
Well, you make an error, and that's exactly, you can quantify this error, and that's exactly the part that you're doing missing here. That is the error that you make. And that is, I mean, if you're sure that this right-hand side is zero inside your box, I mean, it's not affected anymore. I mean, the two electron interactions are not affecting the result anymore.
You're saying you integrate numerically out to the point where the electron-electron interaction is small or negligible.
I mean, you can interpret this in that way. I mean,
an experimentalist measures two electrons. In principle, the Coulomb interaction is there. Are you telling me?
No. Experimental magnitudes.
But you see, that's what this is, the purpose of the calculation, to calculate something which is far enough, which corresponds to the experiment, right? And this is the debate that's going on and will be going on forever.
Yeah, but exactly, I mean, you're sure that for the unequal energy sharing, this interaction doesn't play anymore. It's only for the equal energy sharing that this is affecting the result. And you can quantify the error bound, right? And so it's just a PDE that you're solving. I mean, you use the Green's function. Of course, if you do this form integral, if you're missing a part, you're making a mistake, right?
I would go a bit further, and I would say, even for the equal energy sharing, what would be most sensitive would be the angular distribution.
Right.
The total cross-section,
yeah.
I claim, is not really that sensitive.
Yeah.
Okay? So, because actually it has a flat partition energy, very, very, very less. So,
can you say anything about the inverse problem? Because when you say you want to extract information, then I think information extraction really means you have scattered data, you have scattering intensities, and now you have some complicated object that gave rise to these scattered intensities.
Sure.
That's actually, I think, what information extraction
means. Yeah. So I deliberately gave you this when you do the Born approximation or the Ritthoff approximation, this free integral becomes really some information about the refractive index, right, or the potential in this case, right? And but of course, for the energy ranges where we are doing and for the process that we are looking at, I mean, this Born approximation cannot work, right? And that's why it took so long to calculate these cross sections, right? So indeed, if you have some, I mean, if you start to look at it and maybe you, if you can sample this Fourier transform in enough angles, you might get enough information to do the inverse transform with, instead of Fourier, then have the one body operators inverted. But I don't know anything about it. I mean, I'm just hinting that this is the way. If you wanna, if you're interested, you should figure this out, how to get information from that, right? But in a way, this far field pattern is indeed sampling this Fourier transform all along the line. But you need much more information to actually do some reconstruction.
Yeah, for the inverse problem, you also have the phase problem. You
yeah.
measure the phase in an experiment.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, that's why you have this algorithm to reconstruct the phases.